Hey everybody, the Slackademics debut album, Pass Fail, is finally out. Here's a sampler of the G chords used in all 13 of the tracks on the album. There are two songs that don't have a G chord. Can you tell which ones I had to pitch shift? Okay, maybe just go listen to the album.
I love that song. Sometimes when I'm driving, I like to conduct music when I'm driving.
Yeah.
Do you do that?
With one hand.
Yeah, with one hand.
Not with both hands.
And I like to cue people in.
But see, the thing is, you need to do the cues, you need both hands, right?
Yeah, so sometimes
You conduct the time, everybody. You conduct the time and also certain articulations with your right hand.
And then you...
And you have to cue, you show dynamics, you mm-hmm. quiet everybody down with your left hand.
I love it. But I'd be so good at that.
You need then one of those... cars that the steering column can be controlled by your legs. So then you could actually conduct along.
So I can use my knees to drive while I'm
And when you're listening to the music mm-hmm. on the radio, like if you don't cue them,
they don't know how to do
it. They won't come in.
They won't. And then everyone suffers.
And that's the thing, like following along on the radio, like most people just listen to the radio and they're following the music. But if Nicole's conducting, the music has to be there to happen.
Like, right. Like if I'm not there.
They're not reading the music, right? If you don't cue in the trumpets, they won't come in.
They won't know when to play. I'm Nicole.
And I'm Mark.
And this is Nevermind the Music. What are we going to talk about today, Mark?
If I say a city, is there a musical artist that you immediately associate with it? So like Seattle.
Nirvana.
Right.
Correct.
Chicago. Okay. Chicago Transit Authority. You could also say like Kanye West or like Muddy Waters. Like,
I guess.
Okay.
So.
New Orleans.
Lou Reed. I know that's not right, but that's the first thing I thought of.
Is Lou Reed from New Orleans?
I have no idea.
Louis Armstrong, I would say, like old school jazz, right? Atlanta.
Lauryn Hill. That's what I think
Lauryn Hill's from I thought she was from Jersey.
I don't know. I'm all over the place.
I would say Outkast.
Okay, sure.
Something like that, right? Southern hip hop.
Atlanta.
Right. But so you, I'm going somewhere with this possibly.
Okay.
Boston.
Dropkick Murphys. Aerosmith.
I'm going to make you zoom out.
Letters to Cleo.
Can you go... recent decades, starting with 60s or 70s, what is the Boston artist from each decade?
Oh my gosh.
You've lived here for a couple decades.
The 1900s.
Since the 1900s. So Aerosmith, you're claiming. So
call
them the 70s.
70s, okay.
Dropkick, you could call them 90s or 2000s.
I'm going to say Aerosmith 80s to 90s. Letters to Cleo 90s to 2000s, which you might not know who they are because you're not from here, but you should.
I know Letters to Cleo.
Very good.
They have a cover of I Want You to Want Me on mm-hmm. one of the, a soundtrack. I'm trying to think, the original Here and Now or something, is that them?
Maybe. I went to some free shows when I was a teenager.
Yeah, no, they're good. Yeah.
Then we think 2000 to 2010, I'd say Dropkick Murphys. To 2020 Boston bands. I don't know. Can we say the Slackademics?
That's 2020s.
Oh, 2020s.
Yeah.
Right.
There's a few holes in there. What do we need?
There's bands that I listen
you could
to
also
that
say
are Boston
Pixies.
Bands. Yeah. I love a band called the Macrotones. You would love the Macrotones. And they're a Boston-based band. Trying to live my life. Just trying to make it right. small bands. These aren't like heavy hitting bands.
Like, who's the huge artist from Boston in the 2010s? It's a good question. Something we're forgetting, I think, right?
Yeah. Why don't you just tell me what you want
me
to say?
No, I'm not talking about, I'm not the expert on Boston. Are you kidding me?
Oh, right. Okay. Yeah.
I got here and I had to immediately be like, students, tell me who the Boston artist everybody knows.
Yeah.
I'm going to talk about Los Angeles.
Okay.
Not
that's
San
fair.
Diego, but Los Angeles. I did live in Los Angeles for a decade.
We know.
And
you mentioned
I'm
it.
Not talking about Orange County.
Okay.
Okay.
Not the OC.
The OC.
No,
I'm not talking about the
that.
OC, the TV show or the area. So you need to be in Los Angeles County somewhere, which means either in the city limits or in neighboring communities, ideally. So I'm going decade to decade, and I'm going to tell you not the most famous, the okay. most LA artist of the decade. And this is objective truth. There isn't really any subjectivity here at all. 1960s.
The Beach Boys.
No.
What?
And that's why. So first of all, some of you were thinking he's going to do The Doors, maybe.
Oh,
but The Doors are like an LA band that feels like they're from San Francisco.
Mm-hmm.
That's Jan and Dean. That is not The Beach Boys. And that's why it's the most
tricky,
Los Angeles
tricky.
Artist from the 60s. Because it's a cheap imitation. No, so like LA, that song was written by Brian Wilson.
Yeah, it sounds,
it sounds like a Beach Boys song, but it is Jan and Dean. And there's something about the like LA spirit, but also the second version of it that still feels
that's
the
not 60s. Like a Beach Boy cover.
No, but it was written for them by Brian Wilson.
I see. Okay.
So it feels like the 1960s LA is still up and coming. It's still like not the center of the universe, but people want to be there, starting mm-hmm. to get that, you know, the surf culture. But we're not the Beach Boys. We're the second place, Jan and Dean, that has only a couple hits. 1970s, I'm going Laurel Canyon scene.
Okay.
With the singer-songwriters. You know, you've got the Eagles. You've got Joni Mitchell. Kind of incestuous. Everybody's sleeping with everybody.
Hot.
Hopefully not literally incestuous, Game of Thrones style. And here we have Take It Easy, Jackson Browne. Oh, they're gonna own me too. They're gonna stone me once if she's a friend of mine. Take it. The sound of your own wheels drive you crazy.
That's one of my favorite lyrics ever written.
Don't let the sound of your own wheels drive you crazy.
I love it. I think it's so great.
Most famously an Eagles song, but that's mm-hmm. my point, right?
Right?
It was written by Jackson Browne, who I think was one of their roommates at one point. It was just this post-hippie country / rock and roll scene that people were all hanging out with everybody.
Yeah.
If somebody was even like roommates with Rick James at that era. I'm trying to remember. Like,
okay.
It was just this whole, and again, like I said, everybody dating everybody and writing songs for each other, collaboratively writing these songs together.
So it wasn't
together.
Like, I'm stealing your song. It was like, oh, I wrote the song. It's going to be better for you guys.
It was
take
like,
it.
I wrote the song. Let's both do it. And maybe one of us. And like Jackson Browne did his version on his album and they did their version on their first album.
Wow,
and
that's
there's
been
hit.
A cool. I love that
and
collaboration.
So it feels very LA,
yeah,
right?
LA.
Everybody living in the hills kind of just.
So LA.
Yeah. So 1980s, I could go with the Sunset Strip scene.
Yeah, that's
Van
the
Halen.
Way I had.
Everybody's
yeah.
thinking hair metal. Just on the outskirts of town, we have the hardcore punk thing. Mid 1980s, this is the Minutemen. This ain't no picnic. What pain and agony. On Friday I'll be paid. This ain't no picnic. This ain't no picnic. This ain't no picnic. This ain't no picnic.
So, you know, you would think, knowing what you know about my musical taste, that I don't like punk music.
Yeah.
I actually really like punk music.
Okay.
I really like it. And I think I'm going to make a hot take connection that punk is just folk music with a different outfit on.
And maybe a different tempo and a higher volume.
Right.
Yeah.
But I
they're
think
similarly simple, but not simplistic.
Yeah.
When it's done well. Similarly countercultural or contrarian.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, that one, I chose that, even though you know, we could talk X or other, you know, Black Flag or whatever. But there's something about the Minutemen that, like, if you listen, they have that double album, or they have their sort of magnum opus is Double Nickels on the Dime, and it's got like alternative rock,
cool,
and then hardcore punk that you think of when you think hardcore punk. And it's just like doing whatever they want that really cuts against the expectations of what certainly what's going on in Hollywood with the hair metal bands, right? 1990s. Can't do Snoop. I thought.
Why not?
I thought that.
Just because he doesn't want to.
He doesn't want to be on this podcast this time. We'll get back to him.
He said.
I thought that the Long Beach thing was just a little too. I'm like, I know it's technically Los Angeles County. We might be too far away from LA proper to go Long Beach. So we're going Cypress Hill and Stain in the Brain.
Nice. Can't outright me or kick that style. Wicked, wild. Happy face, you never seen me smile. Rip that mainframe, my legs plain. That like me is going insane. Really,
apparently the censored version.
After every clip you play, I'm always like, "Oh, it's so good!" Yeah. It's so, but it is the song's so good.
So there's something about that and that era. Also, we could talk Red Hot Chili Peppers or something. But
where does Insane Clown Posse fit in all of this?
Not Los Angeles.
No, okay.
I don't think so.
No, probably.
I think they might be Midwest.
Yeah, I feel like that's they have like a Midwest thing.
I don't know. I'm not a juggalo, so I don't know.
He is. Have you ever been to an Insane Clown Posse show?
No, have you?
Yes.
Should we come back to it or
no? I never want to talk about it again.
Really?
It was cool, like from like a cultural observer standpoint, but I don't think it's for me.
You didn't feel a part of the scene.
No, it like felt scary.
Oh wow. Okay, I think we should talk about that another time.
Okay, let's talk about it another time.
So this one though, there's something about the style of hip hop obviously feels very Los Angeles, but also the Latino rappers. There's something very unique about that wouldn't be happening. I think of the hip hop of the 80s. And that there was a lot of, for example, Puerto Rican influence, especially in the dance culture and engagement.
Mm-hmm.
But like the sort of shift that happened in the 90s of broadening of the who was making hip hop and who was, and that went as far as, Vanilla Ice and stuff like that. Also, I thought Cypress Hill is like emblematic, not only of that moment, but of Los Angeles. Brings us to the 2000s and 2010s. Tune in to our next episode for the 2010s of Who My Answer for the most LA artist. The most LA artist of the 2000s. I know you think I'm going to go Black Eyed Peas or Maroon 5 or something, this stuff.
Yeah.
I am going to go System of a Down.
Nice. Well, I don't think you trust in my self-righteous suicide. Angels deserve to die! Ah! Wake up! Grab my shampoo and a little makeup! I just got to fade away.
Sorry, I had to play that whole moment there.
I hate it so much.
Oh, you hate this? Okay, all right. I think you won't hate all of this.
At the beginning, I was like, oh, maybe I like System of the Down. And then he starts with the scream and I'm like, nope.
Okay.
I'm
so
out.
We're going to get there. So, to be clear, they're from Glendale, not technically Los Angeles, but it's just right there. It's like Glendale is closer to downtown Los Angeles than West LA is to the western side of LA is to downtown LA. So it's like the Brookline, right?
Okay.
Maybe
sure.
Not as rich as Brookline, but like Brookline is actually pretty darn close to downtown LA relative to the far end of
it's like maybe
Dorchester,
the Roslindale. Yeah.
Roslindale
is more suburban.
Is technically its own city?
Yeah.
It is? Okay. Mm-hmm. All right.
Rosie.
Should I cut out the geography lesson? Okay. So
it's important.
Why is this so LA? It's super aggressive and weird alternative metal. And it's very Los Angeles, right? So think like we had in the previous decade, I could have also gone with Tool.
Oh,
right?
Yeah.
And this is like a kind of next chapter of that story of the alternative metal that it's also very politically active. Despite the warm weather and the wealth in the city, right? So Serj Tankian, the lead vocalist, primary lead vocalist, that is, started a nonprofit with Tom Morello from Rage Against the Machine.
Okay.
Another band I could have chosen for the 90s.
Right.
It feels like very much a product of that place and that era. This is, speaking of the politics, this is, for example, their song Prison Song, which is the first song on the Toxicity record. Nearly 2 million Americans are incarcerated in the prison system of the U.S. They're trying to build a prison! 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 For you and me to live in! Another prison system! Another prison system! Another prison system!
to sell your prisons. You don't even flinch. All our taxes paying for your wars against the new non-rich.
Okay.
And I know you're going to feel this because you're about to do it to me, but like, it's also very LA. If we look back at the Eagles in the Laurel Canyon, mm-hmm. this band has literally come to blows with each other before, and we could talk about it a little bit later, which is very LA to me for some of the other bands that have been there. And I know you're like looking at me, why are we doing this music?
No, I appreciate the music.
Okay.
I do.
I think I can get you to like some of it.
I like the message.
I think some of it is extreme, though.
Yeah, it's just like, we got it.
And that's a lot, right? For you, that's a lot.
For me,
so,
it's a lot.
Also, LA has the largest Armenian population in the world, except for the country of Armenia in West Asia. So in particular, Glendale. Mm-hmm. So there's something about that also that feel, having lived there kind of when they were at their...
Yeah, that's cool.
Tail end of their heyday, it's like, oh yeah, it felt very LA to have this band of all Armenian American dudes playing really aggressive political metal.
I've recently been learning, this is weird, but a lot about Armenian culture. I had a friend who's Armenian, his dad passed away, went to the funeral a little while ago, and the ritualistic stuff around funerals in Armenian culture was really, really interesting, and learned a lot about it. So
I think you learn a lot at funerals, probably any culture.
I think it's
funerals and weddings,
truth.
You learn a lot.
Yeah, I think it's really important to bear witness to grief and celebration and cultures. Just like I'm about to bear witness to you trying to get me to like System of a Down.
So, and I have no idea where you're going with this. We'll get back to
either.
It. Let's keep going. Okay, all right. This whole new metal thing. The listeners heard me last season. I was talking shit about new metal in the context of doing Incubus, which some people claim is new metal, which I loved. And I'm like, they're not really new metal. And then we did Linkin Park a couple months ago. And I'm like, it's kind of new metal, but I like them too. And now here we are. And people talk about this band as being new metal. But I'm kind of like, I don't know. Because to me, it's more progressive metal or alternative metal. They have the sort of new metal weird voice. Like, Korn would have, but it doesn't have the hip hop influence, really. It doesn't have the electronic influence or the funk influence that you tend to get when you're talking about new metal. It's really a fusion genre. And this is much more like Tool to me, progressive metal, alternative metal, where it's like has more in common with like prog rock or stuff like that. It's weird, but like it's amazing. And the vocals. The two vocalists, so Serge Tankian is the lead vocalist, but then Darren Malakian was the one who would like, they're trying to build a prison. Like, he's the screamy, but also the like melodic, really high, almost punk rock sounding guy. And this band, we can talk about the new metal thing a little bit, but like, they also have just a hauntingness, kind of like Tool. And this is the first song I ever heard by them. This is Spiders. I don't know. Maybe you don't like the screaming, they're going to build a prison, but this tune from their first record, 1998.
The spiders all in tune, the evening of the moon. Dreams are made winding through my head, through my head.
I mean, I like that quite a bit.
Yeah?
It's just the other parts.
Have you heard the Aerials?
No. I guess I don't know System of a Down at all. I think I'm just being having a bias.
Should I pipe in Aerials real quick?
Maybe you're changing my mind.
You've heard Chop Suey, right? Wake up!
Yes.
Like, okay. That song I think of kind of as their signature song. It's not actually their biggest hit. Chop Suey peaked at number 76. It's just really intense. I think maybe it's not for pop, but like, here's Aerials, which actually was more successful, 55.
Aerials in the sky. When you lose small mind, you free your life. Life is a waterfall. We drink from the river, then we turn around and put up our walls.
It's very good. Okay. I'll admit that it's very good. And I've heard that before, and I like it. I kept thinking of what the crowd at these shows must be like.
Mm.
And maybe for me, that's what I don't like. Like, I love seeing live music. So whenever I hear
reminds you
music,
of the Insane Clown Posse, Posse
like,
show?
I think of being at this show and thinking I wouldn't have a fun time at this concert.
I think it's probably dude forward music for the most part.
Yeah, I feel like I'd be scared in the crowd.
I think what you might be reacting to is they don't choose a lane really. Mm. And that's part of what I like about it. Like that song is like kind of heavy, but also there's beauty to it. But then their biggest hit actually is BYOB from 2005. And Hypnotize was also a better hit than Chop Suey. But BYOB hit number 27. And what this is just massive contrast. There's just constant shifting of even what style this is.
Everybody's going to the party, have a real good time. Dancing in the desert, blowing up the sunshine.
But then... We'll come back to that.
That's
but
the same song?
Same song.
Imagine if, and maybe someone in the world has done this, you take the lyrics to that and take the whole song, but instead of having like the distorted guitar, you put like a synth in that same spot.
Okay.
It would sound so, it would sound like Swedish pop music. It would sound like Swedish pop music.
It would be different, but I think that insane contrast and extremes on either side is part of their thing, right? And that feels very LA to me, but also very not Nicole.
Yeah.
Right? So
I've been to LA. It's not for me.
And I think, well, yeah, noted podcast episodes about it. I think part of that extreme contrast is also why people associate it with nu metal, because it's kind of like it's over the top, but it doesn't stylistically have all those traits like Limp Bizkit does or whatever. I want to talk about the song Toxicity specifically, not Chop Suey, though, honestly, the thing I want to talk about does happen in Chop Suey as well. This is Toxicity from their record, Toxicity from 2001.
Oh, what are you on the world? How are you on disorder?
And then there's the pretty part.
I like the pretty parts.
The vocals are incredible in this.
I bet.
I know you may not like the style.
I can appreciate it, though,
it's
for sure.
It's extremely impressive.
Like, singing it live, like, that must be... You need a really solid instrument to be able to do that and, like, be well-trained. Like, you hear kids try to do it, and you just think, oh, you're blowing out your voice.
Serge Tankian wrote the words, but the music for this one is written by Darren Malakian and Shavo Odadjian, who's the bass player. But apparently while they're recording, Darren, the guitarist, and John Domayan, who's the drummer, got into a fight, literally physical fight. Darren hit him with a microphone stand in the head.
Mm.
And apparently the drums to this, that crazy drum part we just heard, was John, the drummer, making fun of Shavo, going, oh, this is what you like, and doing the most like over the top ridiculous thing ever.
They're like,
as
that's
a diss, and then they're like, keep it. Like, so there's something like, again, very LA about these guys like can't get along, but they're creating this cool music.
Yeah.
People definitely talk about this as nu metal, but I think, you know, it's heavy metal. It's got kind of a wobbly voice, but I don't hear the electronic drum beats in the background. I don't hear rapping. Have you looked at the lyrics?
Because
I cannot figure this out for the life of me. I want to talk about tempo changes, but give the lyrics a look and tell me if you can figure it out. Because when I was trying to figure it out, like, I saw references just looking up, like, what is this song? Eating seeds as a pastime activity is one of the lyrics. Refers to apparently Armenian culture. Eating sunflower seeds is a common thing, to the point like it's a stylistic trait, almost cultural trait. It's in the video. They're eating sunflower seeds. Apparently the sacred silence of sleep line refers to Native American spirituality. But there's an interview where Serge, I think, mentions it's actually about ADHD. Like, I have no idea what this is about. So listeners.
Yeah. Flashlight reveries caught in the headlights of a truck. Looking at life through the eyes of a tire hub.
Yeah.
It's a lot of car references.
And it's beautiful. The way he sings those lines is beautiful and haunting, too. It's very conversion software version.
I thought, like, I'm looking at the
7.0?
lyrics, and the first lyrics is conversion software version 7.0. I was like, oh, that must be like a weird thing my computer's... I didn't realize that that's the lyric. How interesting. I think that they were on drugs. Were they on drugs?
I don't know about that, but maybe. So I don't know. I think, again, like ADHD in there.
Yeah, that's fair.
I just keep that as a backdrop, listeners. Like, I don't know. Coming off of an episode where I was centrally focused on the lyrics when we did Tracy Chapman, not happening here because I cannot figure out. I would love to tie them into my spiel about tempo changes. I can't. I do want to talk about tempo changes, but not just any. I want to talk about tempos that are related by ratio. So we call these, ready for a bolded term in the textbook?
Yes.
A metric modulation.
Ooh, I do like that.
So we know modulation already is a fancy pants way of talking about a key change. A metric modulation is when we change the tempo in a way that follows a kind of ratio. So for example, the simplest metric modulation that I can think of, for example, would be the quarter note of the previous tempo becomes the new half note. For example, you go from 1, 2, 3, 4 to 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 3, 4.
Okay.
Double time.
Sure.
Double time is a metric modulation. Half time is the opposite.
When you slow it down.
You would go from 1, 2, 3, 4 to 1 and 2 and... Right. So like 80 BPM going to 160 BPM times two, double time metric modulation, 80 beats per minute to 40 BPM, half time, 50% metric modulation.
It must take a very skilled drummer to do this.
Those metric modulations are easy.
Oh, well, very good.
Sometimes there's weirder ones.
Okay.
And not all tempo changes do that. And sometimes we get metric modulations that are complicated, like we'll see later, like dotted quarter equals triplet eighth, like weird math.
Ugh.
Like that.
Who
but
can do math?
A common
like that?
One would be, especially if you're in simple meter and you go to compound, you know that da 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 da. You could have 80 beats per minute going to 120 beats per minute.
West Side Story. Right?
Yes.
I know that one.
A quarter note equals dotted quarter. Ooh,
ooh,
so things are
fun.
Getting more complicated.
Tricky, tricky.
And this song has metric modulations, though it has two different types. They're not super complicated. But what's cool is the way they are used and the way they are seeded earlier in the song. We see them grow before they actually happen. And so that's what I want to talk about.
Okay.
And I do want to just clarify with a couple examples. Not all tempo changes have a clearly observable ratio. So here's their song called Radio Video from 2005 that just has a slowdown. It does not have, as far as I can tell, like a mathematical relationship between these two tempos. You just go into the reggae.
I'm into it. It feels like Mr. Bungley, kind of.
Did you like the screaming?
I kind of liked it because it didn't last long and it was just enough to make me make me giggle, which I know isn't the intention, but I'm definitely going to talk about cognitive dissonance.
All right.
In a few minutes.
You figured it out. We're going to come back to it.
Oh my gosh, I have it all sorted.
Sweet. So here's another tempo change that is not a ratio, just a slowdown. This has a retardando. Do you know what that term means?
I don't think we're supposed to say that anymore.
The R word? Yeah. It means a slowdown. Take Me Out by Franz Ferdinand, also from 2005.
Fun to count. I love that song. Sometimes
nice.
When I'm driving, I like to conduct music when I'm driving.
Yeah.
Do you do that?
With one hand.
Yeah, with one hand.
Not with both hands.
And I like to cue people in.
But see, the thing is, you need to do the cues, you need both hands, right?
Yeah, so sometimes
You conduct the time, everybody. You conduct the time and also certain articulations with your right hand.
And then you
And you have to cue, you show dynamics, you mm-hmm. quiet everybody down with your left hand.
I love it. But I'd be so good at that.
You need then one of those cars that the steering column can be controlled by your legs. So then you could actually conduct along.
So I can use my knees to drive while I'm
And when you're listening to the music mm-hmm. on the radio, like if you don't cue them.
They don't know how to do
it. They won't come in.
They won't. And then everyone suffers.
And that's the thing, like following along on the radio, like most people just listen to the radio and they're following the music. But if Nicole's conducting, the music has to be there to happen. Like
right. Like if I'm not there.
They're not reading the music, right? If you don't cue in the trumpets, they won't come in.
They won't know when to play.
One more. Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds. I don't know why you're getting off topic here. So this one, 1967, of course, the Beatles. Notably, we've played this before because I had a good example of a key change, I think. And not one of my favorite Beatles songs.
I heard
Not even the top 20. But tempo change and a key change. As far as I can tell, no ratio, just kind of a change. Just vibe it out, Ringo.
It's this tempo change you're discussing.
But not a metric modulation.
It's not a metric. Is it a modulation? Did they change the time signature?
Yes.
Does it go to 4?
It goes from 3 to 4.
Yeah.
So it's changing a lot of things. Key, time, tempo, and meter are all changing at the same time because it starts with this sort of fast 3-4 and then a slower rock.
Oh, I would have labeled it 6-8. A little 6-8.
That's interesting. Let me...
1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, or is it 1, 2, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2. Well, if you put it in the 6-8, then switching to 2-4 or 4-4 is easier.
But you don't, why? It's not a metric modulation. It's just a, you just have to hear the drummer. This is interesting. We don't have time to talk about
it. Okay, there's no
time.
But
there is it 1, 2, 1, 2, or is it beat, 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 2, 3, 3, 1, 2, 3, 2, 2, 3, right? Because if you're counting each of those as a beat, it's not 6-8. It's 3-4. 6-8 is 2 beats per bar, not 3.
Okay.
Not 6. You don't count 6-8. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. You count 6-8.
No, it's in like triplets.
2 with triplets, right? So if it feels like triplets, it's 6-8. If it feels like the bass line, doom, 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 is giving us beats. It's 3-4.
See, for me, that feels like triplets.
That's interesting. Okay. Yeah, I think it's
Do I like know what I'm arguable. Talking about? Do I get it?
I think you're...
I'm close.
You have a master's degree? It's just in the wrong thing. So I think it's arguable.
Maybe you have a master's degree in the wrong thing. That's rude.
Yeah, it's possible, actually. Okay.
Yeah, same.
Should we get back to the song? And
yes,
my question
please.
Is...
I'm so sorry.
Should we... this song, I would say, has actual metric modulations, two different types. Two different ratios at work, and it's sort of foreshadowed early on, and I can explain it. But do you want to talk about cognitive dissonance now?
Kind of do. I started thinking about this idea of cognitive dissonance like a while ago. It always comes up in almost every song we talk about. I can find a way to like bring up this topic.
Almost talk about it.
But mainly for me, when we start looking through the System of a Down songs, I'm really seeing this like dramatic shift between two ideas, like really strong, like I think even like soft lyricals, if you put a different treatment on it, like the lyrics are soft and nice and really talking about like social justice. And then you get into these like scream segments, these like loud drum segments that seem like heavier and much more assaulting to me. And the balance between those two things is calm. Like there's such a dramatic shift between the two, and I can't really like find balance between them. Cognitive dissonance is this discomfort we feel when our beliefs don't really match our behavior, and I'm hearing that in these songs.
Okay.
Like the beliefs and the things they're promoting don't always like match to me with the behavior, almost, right? And it happens a lot in these lyrics, you know, that they're addressing these ideas of cognitive distortion, like the system's broken, but we're still working in the system. They're talking about, and the other songs you talked about, like the song about prisons. What was the name of it?
Prison Song.
Oh, well, that's convenient, right? But in this song about prisons.
Maybe they should have just called it The Song About
Prisons.
The
Song About Prisons. It would have helped me out. they're talking about, like, we believe in a fair and just society, but we're like harming marginalized groups. And this idea that we're doing things that are wrong and we know they're wrong and we're still doing them. And that really is this idea of cognitive dissonance, that you do things that are wrong and you know that they're wrong and you still do them anyway. And can you think of any examples in your life that you do the wrong thing knowing it's the wrong thing?
Define wrong, because I think like eating that piece of cake or whatever is like a micro cognitive dissonance that like everybody experiences.
Well,
like,
yeah,
this is not good for me to have this beer or whatever, or to eat this food that maybe is, I don't, but I'm going to do it anyways. Like, that's like the tiniest level that I feel like is every day. Cognitive dissonance being a type of cognitive distortion, right? Which we've highlighted a few of those in the past, right? Like other biases,
yeah.
Right? So can you think of times in my life that I feel cognitive dissonance, where I do something I know is wrong? I'm stalling because I try to lead a just life.
Cognitive dissonance, right. For
me, like, aside from eating junk or drinking junk, like, yeah, I mean, I think we talked about this when we talked about, the fundamental attribution error. And you reminded me how it worked in our episode a couple weeks ago on Tracy Chapman. And I talked about, like, the guy who cut in line in the exit on the highway, what an asshole he is. But, that is cognitive dissonance. Like, I think I'm a good person. But yeah, sometimes I will do a bad thing in traffic. I will not be in the actual correct lane, but still turn right or whatever, because I do not want to wait in that line.
Right.
Because I am selfishly prioritizing me not being late to work over all the other people. I know enough to know that's a cognitive fundamental attribute, but I still might do it. I'm kind of a goody-goody, though. I don't do, like,
you are.
Nicole, I don't do, like, real bad things that actually I should be ashamed
of. Neither one of us do.
And if I did, I probably wouldn't talk about them on this podcast.
No, it's true. But the examples that you identified, I think, are, like, the most common examples. The fact that, like, we know that smoking is bad and we still smoke cigarettes. And we know that drinking is bad and we still drink. We know we shouldn't. Sorry. I don't do this. You don't either. But we know you shouldn't drink and drive. But plenty of adults I know will have two beers at dinner and then drive home. We know we shouldn't do that, but we do it anyway because we feel like the bad thing's not going to happen to us, right? Or that we're outliers. But these ideas about cognitive distortions that are really, really are interesting to me, and System of the Down brings this up a lot in their music, I'm learning, is when it's literally part of a system of authority that the people above us are telling us to do bad things. So we do them and we absolve any guilt towards that.
I think part of the way that works, like, systemic cognitive dissonance seems to be because of the narratives we tell ourselves around these things. Mm-hmm. So, like, okay, we're not talking about Prison Song, or a song about a prison is what they call it, right?
Yeah.
But if that's an example, like, there's a narrative, an enabling narrative, that people in prisons are bad guys.
Yeah.
That who cares what happens to them? Who cares if people are making tons of millions of dollars or whatever off the prison they're building? Because they're bad. Like, the systemic cognitive dissonance that we're, many of us at least, as a society experience, has to be paired with some kind of a rationale, whether it's patriotism or someone being deserving of it.
Like, right,
that,
like,
rationale has like a mythology to it and is wrapped up in our identity in a way that maybe makes it harder to dispel.
Yeah. And there's something, you're talking about self-concept, right? Like how you see yourself in the world, and a lack of congruence between who you are and what you do. We can call identity dissonance instead of cognitive dissonance. When who you think you are versus who you are two different people. Like, you have a view that you are a fair and just person, but people observe you in a different way, right? Another thing that comes up here to your point about, like, the systems and how we're interacting with the world around us comes into, the word's called moral disengagement.
Right.
Have you heard that term before? Moral disengagement?
No. I know. I can assume kind of what it means.
What's your assumption?
Yeah, so you're just not thinking about it. Like, they have the song BYOB, Bring Your Own Bombs, right? Mm. That song is about the military industrial complex. And that style, everybody's going to the party, have a real good time. It's framed like that chorus is like this rally around the flag. This is great, everybody. Like, we're going to go kill people, right? You disengage from the actual real
yeah, you like
reality of what's right. happening. In
and
that
a lot
bombing,
of times
right?
we often attach the term moral disengagement to conversations about like obedience to authority and how much right. like who's you don't have to really take
sure.
ownership over the action because your boss told you to do it. So a lot of folks, when they display actions rooted in cognitive dissonance, is because someone else told them it was okay to do it.
Okay.
Right? Like, you can drop the bomb because it's not your call. Someone else told right. you to do it, and you can just do it because that's your job. And you're just doing your job. And you're doing your job for good reason, so you can, like, make money and support your family, and you, like, justify it in this way. But what System of the Down's doing in their music is asking us to confront those beliefs, and I think that that's really powerful. To say, like, you don't have to subscribe to what you're being fed by authority, and you can act on your own identity and your own agency. And I think that that's really a great statement.
It's interesting because they're equal opportunity in the sense that, like, they're talking about war, they're talking about prisons. There's a song called Chicken Stew that is, the lyrics, like, a lot of them come from directly, like, quotes from ads they saw while watching a Lakers game. It's about okay. advertising brainwashing us and stuff yeah. like that. Like, it's kind of almost funny when you listen to it. It's goofy sounding because it's this like bouncy but heavy metal song mm-hmm. where they're screaming ad stuff. And it's like the dissonance of in that consumerism, you lose your independent thought sort of is kind mm-hmm. of what I think their point is. So they do seem often interested in the engaging with people's lack of engagement, right?
Yeah. And when you think of a song that's confronting consumerism using a jingle type of motif in the song, what they're doing is they're offering a set. I assume, I've never heard the song, but I assume that they're offering some sort of satire towards marketing and advertising to get you to go against, right?
In the same way that I've like there's an irony to the poppiness of BYOB's chorus, there's mm-hmm. also an irony to how over the top and not catchy and jingly this music is, though. Here's a clip of that Chicken Stew all queued up. Hang on. This is from 2002.
Pepperoni, angry peppers, mushrooms, olive chives. Need therapy, therapy, advertising causes me. Therapy, therapy, advertising causes me. Therapy.
Yeah.
It's like cheeky.
Yes, very much.
And I think that that's part of it, that they're right. like playing with the constructs of advertising to like call them out on their behavior almost, right? But
it's not cognitive dissonance to have the like over the top screaming, you know, and then the pepperoni onion yeah. sauce, like it's not cognitive dissonance, but it's an extreme juxtaposition.
Yes.
The contrast is sort of like when you've got a Tarantino movie and there's this like 60s bubblegum pop song happening during a murder or something like that, right? There's like a discomfort almost with these things getting put together that is maybe kind of like parallel to the cognitive dissonance of like, I know this is trash, but I'm watching this stuff and consuming this stuff and going and buying a right. pizza or whatever.
Which is like really ironic too, if you like look at a big picture here, that System of the Down is challenging consumerism, challenging like the system and authority and these constructs of capitalism. But they're each, I just looked it up, each of them are worth over $20 million individually.
Yeah, they're each a famous band.
They're a famous band.
Yeah.
They're,
I mean, what do they do with that, right, is important.
I'm sure.
But,
I'm sure that they're doing something.
But they're not poor guys.
They're yeah. not poor guys.
Yeah.
So I'm interested in that as like a big picture and a big motif. When we talk about authenticity, how can you authentically challenge capitalism when you're benefiting from capitalism? It's a big question.
Can you?
I'm not sure if you can, buddy.
I think like that brought Rage Against the Machine down.
Right.
I think they couldn't all four of them mutually agree on how you do that.
Yeah.
And System of a Down hasn't been, they're not prolific. They have maybe four albums, maybe five. Two of them come out really close to each other. Hypnotize and Mesmerize come out kind of maybe even in the same year or something like that. I don't think they've put out a record since the aughts, though.
No.
And I don't even know that they broke up so much as they, I don't want to read too much into it, but I think that might be kind of an element. That question yeah. is, you know, when you start a NGO essentially with Tom Morello, how do you then be a multimillionaire, right? And now I'm sure those guys, at least some of them, I'm sure, are giving away tons of money and
activists. I mean, you know, they're giving away money. They're Armenian, and they've given a lot of money to the Armenian Fund to help protect Armenia from genocide. About $500,000 collectively they gave there. They also have given money to finding like bone marrow donors for people that they know and love. They give away some money individually, but even still, yeah, they're...
It's interesting because we are not ever looking through every artist. Did you give enough money?
No,
did you
do of
enough
course.
But it is interesting when you are a protest artist,
yeah,
anti-capitalist artist, to ask the questions, right? Because we're not all, what is it, like Fugazi or whatever, that wouldn't... Like, they were, to a certain extent, at least, just against the idea of monetizing their music at all. I think, I don't remember the specifics, I might have it wrong, but I think it was Fugazi, the punky, kind of emo-ish adjacent band that, like, couldn't make money essentially off of it because of their really strong opinions about the sort of capitalist aspects of the music industry. But then certain protest artists will willingly still... And maybe they do good things with their money, but there's a tension there.
Then
there is possibly even a cognitive dissonance.
This is going to feel really judgy, but if you have a multi-member band that each member of the band is worth over $20 million, to donate a portion of your record sales to the Armenia Fund, they donated $600,000 in 2022. It's a portion of their record sales. I feel like we could be doing more.
Yeah, I'm not going to call them out, but I think it's a question that could be raised.
I'm not calling them out, but right. It's a question.
It's Mark in the edit, except this time... I've got Nicole.
Hi.
Because I realized something after I edited this episode, right before we were about to record another episode. We've been talking a lot about progressive politics and this band and all that.
Yes.
But actually the drummer sort of is notably quite MAGA now. So I don't know. There's not much to say about it, right? We're just kind of like putting it there. Our discussion kind of focuses on whether they're performatively left-wing or real left-wing, but... They're not all that way anymore anyways.
And I think that that goes back to what we talk about in this episode, that where's the line between performative politics and how you genuinely live your life, and knowing this information is going to inform you as a listener as you hear what we're about to say about System of the Down. So back to our programming.
And I noticed while editing, System of the Down is what you say all the time.
What is it?
It is not... definitively the down. It is just one of many downs. System of a down.
Well, add it to the list.
Back to the show. Is it unfair to raise that it only for them? Sure. Is there a contrast there that probably causes them a degree of stress? Probably, right?
Like, yeah.
And you have to maybe look at that cognitive dissonance, right? And what do you do with that if you're an artist or a rich person in general?
And then how do you justify it? Like the narrative you tell yourself, like, yes, I have all this money and I earned this money and it's mine.
And I've done good because our songs stopped all political violence and any capitalistic conspiracy.
No, but like it worked,
you know, but like incrementally, like you could say, no, this is actually interesting though, because this is a piece of like the late 90s, early 2000s aggro metal where I promise you Chop Suey or whatever is used as a hype up song for like frat boys to haze the new freshmen. You know what I mean?
Right.
Like, or there's like conservative Wall Street investors snorting cocaine while listening to Prison Song by System of a Down before they go out and exploit the world or whatever, right? Like the because of the style of music, is this one of those moments where the message could possibly be lost by some people and they just go, yeah, and they don't listen to the words where they're actually trying to make you think of war or poverty or the Armenian genocide. I know they have references in their songs from the early 20th century, like where the message can get lost. And so, look, that's not their fault. I mean, they wanted to write songs that were political and they wanted to make that be aggressive music. But
like
plenty of people listen to Rage Against the Machine and don't even stop at once
to think of the lyrics and what they're saying.
Their political beliefs do not align at all with what
they're just looking like for a catharsis of their anger. And a lot of music at this time period, if you look at like Woodstock 99, like if you like this place to put this anger,
male aggression in particular, like
to put it.
Early millennial, elder millennial, late Gen X anger.
And it needed to go somewhere. Yeah. And I think System of the Down, if you don't really read into their history and read into their lyrics and you just need some place to go and scream, this is a place to go and do that. And I think that there's merit in that too.
Yeah.
But it's that dissonance for me of trying to balance, like, okay, we're talking about systems of oppression, and I'm just now looking up the homes that these folks live in.
Oh, please.
Okay. And like, it's hard to balance that for me. I'm having like a dissonance in balancing that.
I look, I don't want to be, oh, please. Like, I don't want to yuck your yum there or yum your yuck.
I was just curious.
But it's, we can't, fundamentally, I'm still a music first guy and a lyric second guy. So like, there are plenty of songs that I don't even really listen to the context of the lyrics, and then I don't obsess. If these guys were doing problematic things, I would be more mad at. Look, is Bernie right that billionaires shouldn't exist? Maybe. But I don't want to get in the habit where we're looking at, like, you and I have full-time jobs in a part of the world that is pretty, aside from ice storms and stuff, pretty safe. Do you donate enough of your money to charity? Maybe you do. Maybe you don't. But like, I look, if I had $20 million to myself and I had a beautiful home in Glendale, California, or whatever, that was worth $10 million or whatever, maybe, yeah, you should look at me and say, are you donating enough? But I also don't want the stone throwing through the glass house too much, because it all is relative, right?
It's totally all relative. But also the difference is I'm being judgy just to like to offer good conversation here. I'm not, I know that if I had that money, I'd live in a really nice house too. Like I'd have an
outdoor, also like why,
for sure.
Why, sorry to interrupt.
It's okay.
Is it though?
No.
Why?
God.
Why the one rock band that's all West Asian immigrants or children of immigrants, the one that anybody can name, the four Armenians that most Americans can name, is the one person we look at and go, you're not donating enough. And I'm not accusing you of that, but like, there are a lot of people that we're not even engaging. Whereas we're like, why aren't you? Oh, you helped your community, huh? You're increasing awareness of the Armenian genocide by spending, $500,000. Why not $600,000? It's not like I'm tithing 10% of my income to the countries that my parents immigrated, their families immigrated from 100 years ago. But so it's like, I don't want to put them on a different standard. Although you could say they have chosen to make themselves outspoken politically.
Well, they've made their money.
Better not be hypocrites.
They've made their money. Not that they've chosen to. They've chosen to capitalize, and you could argue, on uprooting systems of oppression. That's how they made all this money.
They're exposing themselves to that criticism, like, in a way that we aren't, because I have chosen to make my money off of talking about music to a bunch of college students.
It's true. And so, you know,
if I was a hypocrite about music, you could criticize me.
Sure you do give back to your community in the way that you can that seems relative to you, but you didn't make your money opposing systems of oppression and then contribute to those systems of oppression. You know what I mean?
Wow. I think it's arguable that I don't contribute to the systems of oppression. I think as much as I work at a community college that is actually free if you're a Massachusetts resident, and I try to empower my students, you could also say that I am an agent of a fake meritocratic structure that is prioritizing European colonial ways of knowing. And like, there's a way that you can talk about me being a public servant by working underpaid at a public college that gives away free tuition to Massachusetts residents, or you could turn it that actually I am keeping people down by being a gatekeeper to knowledge, right? And both of those could be true. Talk about cognitive dissonance.
Right, that's
I have to tell myself one of those narratives.
Yes.
Because I actually think about this. Folks, I don't teach at like a fancy, expensive college, like Berklee College of Music, whatever. Sometimes I go, man, I'd probably make more there and I'd be more prestigious, but man, could I sleep at night?
Yeah.
Berklee's great. You learn a lot, but also you pay so much for what you learn.
That's true.
Would I really be comfortable? Whereas now I'm sending students out in the world, having taught them something useful that in a lot of cases cost them literally nothing except for sweat equity.
And I
sleep at night well with that.
And I'm sure you do put work in to decolonize your curriculum.
100%.
And to honor outlier narratives or bring in new narratives to the story that you're telling your students. And a lot of people aren't doing that. So while you don't have like the money to contribute, you are still like making a difference. And they are too, by just like forefronting these issues to people that may not know about them.
So that's where we look at like, am I doing enough is one question you can ask, but you could also ask, am I doing better than others maybe and better than has been? And I would say, yeah, okay, the answer is there. So we could look at them and do the same, right?
Yeah.
Are they doing enough? Maybe not. Are they doing better than others? maybe yes.
And so, really, it doesn't matter what we think, right? We can talk about this idea of identity dissonance that we're saying, like, you know, maybe you could say like they're not doing enough, but it doesn't matter. Because if they view themselves as altruistic people that are making a positive difference in the world, like that's enough. That's all that needs to happen, right? It's like the judginess of this dissonance and this moral disengagement that gets us into hot water, right? When we start with this comparative stuff. So I'm just bringing it up for the, because I think it's a good conversation to have, to balance those two things for me is becoming challenging.
I think so.
That's
I think
all.
You and I fall slightly differently, but I think it's a struggle. I think it's,
yeah.
And I still don't know 100% how cognitive dissonance fits in with this song specifically, but I think it got us to an interesting conversation about this band.
Yeah, that was the goal.
Yeah. Can we, almost an hour deep, can we talk about music now?
Yeah, okay. Sorry.
We're talking about metric modulations here, and I don't have to harp on this too much. I'm going to give you some examples. But first, we got to establish the groove here. We got to establish the rhythm here. This song is in compound meter, which means the beat divides, you said, into triplets, right? So instead of 4-4 going 1-2-3-4, which would be 1-2-3-4, each of those beats is three parts. 1-2-3-4.
Fun.
Three divisions of the beat plus three divisions plus three gives us 12. So we actually call this 12-8. And so this song is in 12-8, 78 beats per minute, 78 dotted quarter notes. This is that overall 12-8 groove here. 1-2-3-4. Yeah. Got it?
Yeah.
1-2-3-4.
I'm in.
Yeah, you're in. Great. So the rhythm is clear there. There's a lot of chaos in the way it's presented, but essentially we have a clear, solid 12-8. We go into the mellow, pretty verse with the confusing lyrics, and we still have clarity with our 12-8.
Conversion, software version 7.0. Looking at life through the eyes of a tire hub.
1-2-3-4. 12-8. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Feel me?
Yes.
All right. Just after that, something comes in, a second guitar part giving a dotted rhythm. Not the dotted chord is the da, ta, but something that cuts against. We're dividing the beats in half instead of in three. So there's a guitar that cuts with this da, 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 da. That you're going to hear come in that starts to suggest a different meter.
Eating seeds is a pastime activity.
Da.
The toxicity of our city,
You hear that? That almost sounds like it's 6-4. Because
okay.
Think about it. We have a 12-8 going 1-2-3-4. If I took those eighths and instead made them into pairs of two, mm-hmm. it would go from 1-2-2, 1-2-3-4-5-6. So we have the layer of the six against the layer of the 12, which is really a layer of four. Because 12-8 is four groups of three.
Yeah.
6-8.
Fractions.
Or six then would be, yeah, right. If 12 is four groups of three, six is six groups of two, both happening simultaneously. This is suggesting some things that might change later in the song.
It's wild because
right?
It's all 12.
It all adds up to 12, but it's where are you emphasizing?
It's like the subdivision.
Are you emphasizing 1-2, or 1-2-3-4-5, right? It's a different way of emphasizing the same total number. And this is going to lead to metric modulation later, right? So we finally get to the chorus. Here we go. We're still in 12-8, right? Anything rhythmically interesting here?
Oh, what are you on the wall? How are you on the disorder? Disorder. Now, somewhere between the sacred silence and sleep. Somewhere between the sacred silence and sleep. Disorder. Disorder. Disorder.
feels like they're in conversation with each other.
Mm.
Feels like two different
John
things talking
making
to
fun
each other.
Of Java the bass player with his drum part. Yeah, is in conversation. The different sections are, or the different layers are?
The different layers are, kind of.
Can I highlight one bit here?
Yeah.
When he says, somewhere between the sacred silence and sleep, I think is the line.
Somewhere between the sacred silence.
One, two, and a three, and a four. We get one. Da 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 da.
Yeah.
So somewhere between the sacred silence is a version of what we call a hemiola, where you have like a different meter pushing against. He's doing quarter notes, almost like a little 4/4 bar in there. One and two and three and four, and somewhere between the sacred silence. And it kind of is lopsided against the instrument. So here's what just the vocals sound like.
No, somewhere between the sacred silence and sleep.
So if you just did that somewhere between the one and two and three and put against the instruments, it doesn't quite fit.
Somewhere between the sacred silence.
So just like the guitar earlier was suggesting this other meter that could be pasted on top of the 12/8, this is pasting almost a 4/4 on top of the 12/8. We haven't changed, but it creates, there's tension, dissonance, sort of rhythmic, between the different layers, as you said. The drums are still fine in 12/8.
Yeah.
Vocal is not fine in 12/8.
No, and like it's meant to give you that feeling of like unsteadiness almost.
I would say so, yeah.
He's a great lyricist. Like vocalist, I mean.
Vocalist, yeah.
Yes.
Oh, yeah. I don't even have any idea. He probably could sing classical music.
It's really impressive. When you just isolate the vocal, you're like, oh, wow. Like, that's hard.
And I'm not saying that like classical music is necessarily harder, but there's like a control over the voice that he has that a lot of like metal singers don't. Some of them do.
Right.
You know, Ronnie James Dio or whatever. I think Maynard from Tool could sing like, but just to control what's happening in your vocal cords.
And I think that's very interesting because a lot of times when you're like trying to sing this music, I imagine like younger, like people would just shout it and scream, but there's an art to it.
You have to like support your, like especially doing this on tour every night or whatever.
It's really, I have a lot of respect for singers that sing this type of music.
Yeah, it's really hard to do well. Yeah. Okay, so none of this is metric modulation. I'm just telling you the little seeds of the idea that happened in the first half of this song.
Nice.
Eventually, we get to the bridge and we have an actual tempo change. I'll first play it and then we'll talk about what we're doing. It's sort of simple, sort of weird.
Disorder! Disorder!
I like that, I think.
So it speeds up.
Yeah.
Now, this is a sort of simple type of metric modulation. It has a simple ratio, but kind of a weird relationship with the meter. So what's happening, we have 12/8 and 78 beats per minute is the song. And now it doubles to be 12/8 in 156 beats per minute. But the weird thing is, double time is really common in 4/4. Because think about it. If I'm counting 4/4, 1 and 2 and 3 and 4 and... we're already cutting that beat in half. One and two and just becomes one, two, three, four. Here, the half layer doesn't make sense in the meter because the meter's going one and a, two and a. It's not like they're taking the one and. They're taking one and a half of those. We're going one and a, two and a, three and a, four and a, one, two, three, four. What it is that guitar part earlier, 12 divided by two is six. The 6/4 becomes the new tempo, right?
Yeah.
It's a metric modulation of double time, but double time doesn't fit the math of 12/8 because it should be like triple time or
right.
something.
Right, okay, I get you.
The beat doesn't cut in half in 12/8, but they've done it anyways, right? Am I losing you?
It's like hard to track, but I understand like the 30,000 foot view of it.
Basically, they've just multiplied the tempo by two.
Yeah.
But this meter doesn't deal in twos. This meter deals in threes. So it's a weird kind of ratio.
And that's why
it's,
it feels like there's like a disjointedness to it when you listen to it. It like
I think
shifts
so. This
in a way that like doesn't feel like a very organic shift. It feels like an inorganic shift because of the math.
Double time is actually really common in like ska music.
Sure.
You've got like a reggae beat and then you double time to play the fast ska.
Mm-hmm.
And people, I don't even know, really notice it sometimes. It
because
happens
it all,
so
like,
organically.
It just feels like they're playing 16th notes instead of 8th notes.
Kind of,
yeah.
Right? With a pick it up kind of feel.
Yeah.
there's something about this moment that feels like a new thing is happening. And it's because the ratio, the times two ratio doesn't really
match up
to do with anything we've heard, except for the guitar earlier with the dun, 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 and his somewhere between suggests kind of these different layers pasted on top.
They were like laying the foundation so we could like be on beat now if you were just following that beat from later up until this point.
So let me play it just now that we've heard it. Let's do it. You got it though. You've got it.
Disorder! Disorder!
But it's not 4-4 either. It's a new 12-8.
Right.
So the math is like slow divided by three, take half of that and divide that by three. So like the ratio is very odd.
The ratio is different on paper, but like the toe tap is the same. Like when you like tap your foot
the
to
big
it.
Tap is the same big tap. Yep.
Yeah. The toe tap.
How do they get at that? Right.
This is a science term.
Then we go back to the chorus. So let's hear them get back to. So now the dotted half of the fast tempo, half the bar, becomes the new quarter of the bar. Let me count it. 1, 2, 3, 4. 1, 2, 3, 4. 1, 2, 3, 4. 1, 2, 3, 4. 1, 2, 3, 4. 1, 2, 3, 4. Right?
Yeah.
It's cool. It's a
cool.
Simple metric modulation, except for the way that these meters divide doesn't quite feel natural.
But it still like feels unified in a way. There's a thread. There's a thread through it all.
Right.
Yeah.
And so double time is a super common metric modulation, but in 6-8 and 12-8 like this, it's not as common.
Mm.
And so how does it end? We go into this outro, but this time they go to double time again and then return. But instead of returning to 12-8, they return to 4-4. So now each beat becomes half of the beat. Like, listen to it. It's just a different feel.
Disorder! Disorder!
So we go 1, 2 instead of going back to we go 4-4, which is just super different. So,
and then they switch again, don't they?
That's the end of the song.
Oh, that's the end of the song.
That is literally how the song ends.
Yikes.
And this herky jerky, what style of music are we hearing from song to song? But even within the songs, this band does a lot of tempo shifting to accommodate that, to go from like the, you know, the reggae versus the screaming in the when we heard Radio Video, that wasn't a modulation of the meter, but it was, that's just a metric modulation. It's not the meter that has to modulate, it's the tempo. That's a weird term. Stupid music theory people. But the tempo changes highlight this extreme contrast that they're all often doing. Can I show you a few other songs that do this?
I'd love to hear other examples from different genres.
Yes.
Yeah.
So we're definitely going to get that.
Okay.
First, two examples from this band, and then we're going to leave
the
band.
They love it. They're like so stoked on it.
Famous, I would say their signature song, even though it's not their biggest hit, Chop Suey. This bit we're going to hear has three tempos. It goes to halftime. It starts, what we're going to hear starts halftime, then goes back to regular kind of time with most of the song, and then we get double time within the span of a few seconds. Not a few seconds, half a minute.
Well, I don't think you trust in my self-righteous suicide.
Double it again.
Wake up. Grab my
so yeah, 1, 2, 3, 4. 1, 2, 3, 4. 1, 2, 3, 4. Wake up.
Yeah.
And then we go, we pull back. Okay.
I like it. That's easier to track for me.
Right. It's straightforward.
Yeah.
4-4, right? It's not 12-8. Okay. Yeah. BYOB, when we transition from the verse to the chorus, we also have a pretty straightforward double time half modulation thing.
Still you feed us lies from the tablecloth. La 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 la.
Ooh, everybody's going to the party, have a real good time.
Who else is singing there?
There might be backing vocalists, yeah. But Darren
sounds like a
comes
female.
In, I think, to harmonize. I think that's a female vocalist then. But then later, there's just a tempo change that doesn't appear to be, as far as I can tell, a metric modulation with a clear ratio.
Dancing in the desert, blowing up the sunshine. Blast off! It's party time! And we don't live in a fascist nation! Blast off! It's party time!
Yeah, so that's Darren in the harmony, the pretty harmony, and then the screams, too. So not the lead guy, the other guy. Question? Exclamation point from 2005. Song. Slow 6/8 to fast 5/4. This is the most complicated of them, I think, because we have the eighth note becomes the quarter note, and we get a major meter shift. So take a listen.
When we go.
That's trickier.
Yeah. Well, also we got the five, which in of itself.
Who's doing that?
You know, we were just listening to Evermore in the car. We're back to Taylor in the car with my daughter.
Nice.
That has two songs and five on it.
That's wild. Which
There's
ones?
Two of them.
I don't really know Evermore that much. I'm saving it.
Evermore is feels a little bit, sorry, Tay-Tay, feels a little bit like the B-sides of Folklore.
That I'm like waiting to listen to it until I need it.
The Tolerate It is in 5/4.
Oh, I like that song quite a bit.
And watch you tolerate it. If it's all in my head, tell me now. Tell me I've got it wrong somehow. I know my love should be celebrated, but you tolerate it.
And then
Tolerate is a beautiful, lyrically
closure?
It's really beautiful.
Hang on. Yeah. Enclosure is in like 5/8.
I know that it's over. I don't need your closure. Your closure.
Which is a little more
That's
raucous.
Wild.
Anyways, nobody cares. Well, they care, but nobody asked. How about that? Okay. So Leaving Them, Red Hot Chili Peppers, 2022 record, Unlimited Love.
Okay.
I know you're a big fan.
I'm a fan.
The verse is in, the song's called Veronica, verse in 4/4, chorus in 6/8. The dotted quarter note becomes the half note.
Danger, danger, everyone loses their mind. My name is Nebraska.
It's a cool ratio because we get a one and a two and a one and two and three and four.
It sounds, I'm my ears are getting like a little treat now.
Yeah, a reward.
Kind of like a little cleanse.
Right. This is Hurricane Eye by Paul Simon, 2000.
Oh, this is going to really send me over the top,
Verses in 4/4, chorus in 6/8. So going in the different direction.
When speech becomes a crime, silence leads the spirit over the bridge of time. Over the bridge of time, I'm walking with my family, and the road begins to climb. And it's Lord, how we gonna pray?
I feel like he does that a lot in his music.
I don't know, I have to think about that.
Kind of like floats above the meter.
I bet it happens in Graceland a few times because his some of the. That feels like Graceland-y to me, even though that's from way later than that album came out. Yeah, he is always kind of floating above some highly complex rhythmic thing.
And it's all him. Yeah. Well, and Garfunkel, sometimes.
Well, I mean, no, the whole deal with that Graceland album is he went to South Africa and found all these like local musicians to play and sing.
Demzels,
and so he's got like these grooves that are completely different from the sort of folk rock
Like
stuff.
On the soles of
and
shoes,
he's, pasting these like Paul Simon songs on top of rhythmic frameworks that are much more complex in some
And I think it's
cases.
Really intriguing. And
maybe
a
we'll
real palate cleanser to the ears.
All right, last example. Juilliard String Quartet.
Okay.
Playing Elliot Carter's String Quartet No. 1 from 1951. This is highly modernist. I think the term metric modulation may have really been invented to describe things like this.
This is where they coined the term.
It may not be exactly this, but this is when you need the term.
They were like, we needed something.
We need something.
This.
We can't just say double time, right? Because you're going to hear some things, and we really would need to look at the score to follow it because it's rhythmically chaotic. But around the second loud chord you hear, the double dotted quarter note gets translated to become the new quarter note. So that's a ratio of what one in a double dotted quarter note is one in 7/8, I think, beats turns into one beat, 64 beats per minute. And then around the quiet part you hear near the end, that quarter note becomes an eighth tied to a dotted eighth. And we go from the ratio of one to eighth tied to dotted eighth is a eighth note plus 1.25. One becomes 1.25.
Like, just play the clip.
Point being, what we have is, in some cases, almost irrational numbers.
Okay.
It's not quite going to the ratio of pi, but like we get weird.
It's getting weird.
Elliot Carter will do something where like this eighth note is your new sextuplet or like septuplet 16th. Weird stuff like that.
Okay. Thinking of like the music that plays inside your head might be this, and the music plays that plays inside my head might be like Paul Simon's Graceland.
This stuff is a part of me. I don't write this kind of music, but like I've heard a lot of it, and it
suits you.
This is one of these things where you have to ask yourself, like, especially as a composer, I have to ask myself sometimes, like, okay, string quartet, you have to count. You're going to learn this so that the quarter note is actually now dotted eighth tied to an eighth note, and you got to get that math, or they could just kind of vibe it out and speed up a little bit.
Yeah,
right.
I would be doing that
or whatever it would be. Slow down, right? And like, can you perceive as the listener with such rhythmically chaotic music? Can you even perceive the difference between? It's not like it's third time or half time. It's a ratio that we don't really intuitively understand. You have to work really hard to learn that. Juilliard String Quartet, super good group. You could put out the question, is it worth the effort? Or just say, slow down a little bit or speed up a little bit or not quite halftime, but a little slower. And the musical result could be the same.
Do you find that like there are some musicians that really like the math part of it and like figuring out that?
Absolutely.
And there are some that would rather just be more organic.
Correct. And I think that person doesn't play Elliot Carter.
Fair enough.
If you want to be more organic, you're not interested in that. You're going to play Zorn, random chance, like, improvisation, you know, it's just
of course,
there are people that are like the ratios,
right?
And that
really,
and there's some
that.
People that don't. I think
another thing I'm observing in this conversation, and I've thought it before, but it's really apparent today, is that both of our fields are really working to name things that exist already, like to put language around motifs and language around behavior.
Well,
so
sure.
We can have like a common conversation about it.
I mean, I think that's intuitive and obvious for psychology, right?
But
you're
I
not
think
like creating ways people do things. You're explaining human behavior, especially like sociology, that side of it, social psych. Music theory, I think I've said this before. I didn't coin this or I didn't invent this, but music theory is not prescriptive, but descriptive.
Right. I've been thinking about that a lot. You have said it before, and it's like kind of, it keeps ringing around my head. Because it's like we're trying to like force, not force, but really trying to assign labels to things when really it could just be like they play a little faster, they play a little slower.
The reason why, let's just say this is why you need the term metric modulation. I know it's not literally this composer that would be the first person anybody said that, but let's say this is why we needed this new term. It's because he was trying to do that deliberately.
Yeah.
Right. So it's rare that, you know, like composer that I really like, French composer Olivier Messiaen, literally composing music while in a concentration camp in World War II, which is crazy to think. the world premiere of Quartet for the End of Time happened because the like Nazi officers in this camp wanted to be entertained. And they said, oh, you're a musician. Write us some music. The cello part uses only three strings because the cello they randomly had in this Nazi camp literally only had three. That's how crazy the story is. He wrote in his life essentially a music theory book that is explaining every little thing he did. But Olivier Messiaen was not going around saying, and other people need to write music like this, right? Usually, even when people, Paul Hindemith or whatever is another one, kind of invents a way of music theory to fuel his own composition, they're usually not going around proselytizing it, trying to get other people to do it. Most of the time, they're just nerdy enough that they're like, I'm going to tell everybody what I did. But music theory usually is other people listening to the music, figuring out what they did and coming up with an explanation for it. Right. So when we talk about like the rules of harmony from Bach and Mozart, like those guys didn't come up with that. They were just doing a thing and later people
labeled it.
Figured out what it meant. And so music theory should never be taken to be like a set of rules you follow. It's a set of observations explaining more like a naturalist or a zoologist, like, oh, the ants are doing that thing. We're not like getting the ants to do anything. You are observing what they're doing and trying to figure out why their little eusocial relationship works amongst the hive, right?
In doing that, you're kind of establishing like an interplayer reliability that the next person can replicate what that first person did because you're putting parameters and rules around it.
The next observer, though.
Yeah, or the next creator.
Interesting.
It's like there's a snake eating its tail almost.
Yeah, and is that good? Does that make music have more value? Does it make it have less value?
I think it makes it have definitely has more academic value because you can analyze it in a more distinct way, in a more universal way, which I think is very cool.
I think the universality there is interesting because, it's something doesn't have more value because it can be analyzed, but connections can be more easily made if you have a common language between different kinds of things.
I think it's very cool.
Any fun way to end? Because we've actually gone long crazy on this one.
I bet. The only thing I can think of is you talked about the OC at the beginning of the episode, the show The OC.
Did I? I said we are not talking about Orange County. We're talking about L.A. Okay.
And I wanted to, I made a note being like, end with the OC.
I went to high school with one of the guys on.
Shut your mouth.
I say
Which
that
one?
Like he was my brother's age, so I didn't really know him.
Whatever.
But
we're not
still my mom. I'm in college. My mom's like, oh, we have to go watch Adam.
Like, Adam. That's all I got. I never watched the OC. So I don't even have a fun tidbit about it. I was more of a California Dreams type of girl.
The Lynx. I've never even heard of it.
Oh, Adam Brody, are you talking about?
Should I not name drop Adam Brody on our podcast?
I think does he know you by name? Can we like reach out to him?
I have one of those.
Adam.
Myself, like I've barely ever talked to Adam Brody, but my name is memorable enough. My last name.
Yeah.
That if they said the name of my brother, he's probably like, oh yeah, I went to high school with that guy or I went to middle school with that guy. Like that doesn't mean you know him well, but my name is weird enough that
it would stand out.
You know,
I think you're selling yourself short. This might be a classic case of...
Should we get him on the pod?
Identity dissonance.
I don't think
You don't think you're memorable, but you are memorable, Mark.
All right. Should
you
we
have
get,
merit.
Should we get Adam Brody on the pod?
Yeah. Why don't you call him?
It's like my old friend, Michael Serrazio. Hey, come on the pod. And I'm doing the same thing. He's like, I don't even remember you, man. I like met him at like an Indian guides camping trip when I was 9 or whatever. All right.
Indian guides in the OC. No one called it that.
But I think they did call it that, but we were San Diego. Anyways, I don't know. We'll cut somewhere.
Nevermind the Music is hosted by Nicole Batcher and hosted and produced by Mark Poppany. You can email us at nevermusicpod@gmail.com and give us a follow on social media. Nevermind the Music is also part of the Lorehounds Network. Please join the conversation on their Discord server. Thanks for listening.